It's Legal Defense with Kirk O'Bear on 1330 and 101.5 WHBL.
Good morning once again, and welcome to Legal Defense with Kirk O'Bear. That's me. And John Birdsall joins me once again. How you doing, John?
I'm doing great.
Good.
Glad to be back.
You know, every time I ask that question, you have the same answer. One of these days, I'm going to ask you how you're doing. You'll be like, yeah.
I'll be like, you know, things are kind of like down in the dumps, and then I'll go on for like the whole hour, just explaining to you how wretchedly things are actually going, and then you'll be sorry you're ever asked. You
know, 1 week when I'm completely exhausted. Some Saturday morning after having done a week-long trial or something like that, I'll just reserve that. Build up your complaints. Do that. Just make a list.
Okay, right.
And then just let them run.
Fly. I'll be like, we'll go through the year. Let's start in January. This is my complaints.
It is kind of a rhetorical question, though. I mean, how often do you ask somebody how you doing and expect an answer other than great? I mean, it's just like... That's the answer you want,
well,
right?
Plus,
you don't really want a full explanation.
Well,
about
plus,
how
if you're
going
to tune into the radio, do you really want to hear about other people's problems? You got your own problems. You know?
Yeah.
So no.
I mean, we like to talk about people's legal problems, but
well,
I
that's
know.
Yeah.
I mean, that's a downer.
Other people's drama. That's our job. You know. I mean, that's just what we're sort of designed to do here.
So an interesting case that came out earlier this week, and you know, I first heard about this and. People are talking about a ruling that has to do with a stingray. And I thought, you mean like the animal that lives in the ocean?
Yeah, or the ones you visit.
The Corvette.
The ones you visit at the aquarium. Yeah.
No, actually, a stingray in this context is a surveillance type device. Well, you know more about it than I do. What exactly is a stingray?
Well, what it is, it's a cell site simulator. So what it does is when you make a phone call, your phone emits a signal and it pings off of the nearest cell phone tower. Well, what this does is it simulates the cell phone tower, and it allows the police to literally walk through apartment buildings or drive down the street of, you know, just a residential street of houses and wait for the ping to come back from your phone. And it can locate things within a few meters. So it like not only knows if you're in a house, it knows like which room you're in.
Because presumably the cell phone is on your person. Is that what it is?
Yeah. Presumably. Yeah. Or at least that, you know, you're associated with that phone. It's sort of like that reasonable inference that is so popular in the law, you know?
Mm-hmm. Now, how is this different than many cell phone devices that have GPS capability, you know, down to the meter as well, you know? And if I'm sure the police don't have access to anyone's, you know, GPS information live, but, you know, if the FBI gets its way with forcing Apple to comply with all of its wishes, then I suppose they'd have access to be able to tell where your phone is. I mean, you know, you can log in on that Apple site, if you can't find your phone and it's like under your couch cushion or something like that, and then you could say, "Where is my phone?" and it'll do two different things. It'll tell you on a map where it is, and then you can also ask it to, you know, make a sound so that you can find it.
Right, but you're doing that all consensually.
For people like me that are always losing their phone,
you're doing that all consensually, though. You know, you're doing that by choice because you want to find your very expensive lost phone, you know, and
okay.
I've done the same thing. But this is not consensual. And in fact, the judge said that the government may not turn a citizen's cell phone into a tracking device. It really goes back to
So this is based on a case that just came out earlier this week.
Right.
And you were just telling me about it before
right.
we kicked off the show. But what's the ruling basically?
The ruling is that. If they're going to use this stingray technology, they have to apply for a warrant from a judge. And that wasn't what they were doing. As you well know, they were local law enforcement were getting the stingray technology from the FBI with the express condition that they not ever mention it in court and they keep it a complete secret. And
that didn't last for too long, I guess.
Well, some privacy outfits like the ACLU had caught wind of this because it had leaked out in some other, you know, circumstances. Well, this was in federal court, and this was a federal judge in the Southern District of New York who just said, no, that you can't do that. And in fact, the DEA, the Department of Justice, has actually changed its internal policies because they now require agents to obtain a warrant. So they've just given up on the whole secrecy thing because they knew that this was coming. And they based the ruling, I think, on some very sound logic. You remember that Kylo case a few years ago? Where they said that, no, you can't use thermal imaging devices to determine if there's a grow operation.
That was the case that jumped in my mind because it's very similar to that.
Right. In fact, here's a quote from Kylo, which sort of sums up the exact same concept that is involved with the Stingray, which is, quote, where the government uses a device that is not in general public use to explore details of the home that would previously have been unknowable without physical intrusion, the surveillance is a search and is presumptively unreasonable without a warrant. So,
wait a minute. What about when I was a kid in the 1960s, early 1970s, and you remember getting comic books and you looked in the back and they had those ads for things you could get. X-ray vision, glasses. Mm-hmm. I never bought them because I never saved up my $1.25, you know, to buy it. But it seems like that would also violate the by the way, I don't think that's a real thing. I don't know how they got away with
think they don't,
advertising.
I think they don't actually work. But it's really fun to pretend that they do. I think those is that like the back of Boy's Life? Yeah, because I used to get this.
Well, I think it was in like regular comic books too.
Those are the same place you would see the ads for the hovercrafts that you would insist.
Yeah.
You would go to your parents. It's like, we have to get this. We have to get a hovercraft.
Well, I wanted how you could buy a whole family of sea babies or whatever they were.
Oh, God. Yeah. The sea monkeys.
That's yes. it.
Yeah. No. Oh, that's as bad as a chia pet. Yeah. No. My parents were having none of it.
Yeah. Well, had a very deprived I guess childhood. the idea that people would like to look beyond the barriers, so to speak, it's been a fascination we've had for quite a long time. But yeah, that Kylo case, the thermal imaging, that, you know, when I figured out that the police were doing that when that case came out, that was really offensive to me because it's literally, you know, seeing through walls. When you're talking about the privacy of the home, which of course is the entire point of the Fourth Amendment, that's what they were talking about primarily. When they're talking about an expectation of privacy, that highest level of privacy is in the place you reside, your home.
Well, in fact, they even reach back all the way to the 80s for a case involving a beeper, and because the Supreme Court had said that monitoring a beeper in a private residence violates the Fourth Amendment and the need to interpose a neutral, detached magistrate between the citizen and the officer. Engage, you know the old saying, engaged in the often competitive enterprise of ferreting out crime. So, I mean, it's the same, you know, it's the same sort of, I think you can draw straight lines between those cases. And I'm glad to see that that's being applied seriously. Now, I don't know what's going to happen when it hits, you know, when this Stingray thing hits the Supremes. I can tell you what Scalia would have done, and this is one of the times that I always like Scalia is when he would have
upheld the decision.
To
require a warrant. Yeah,
absolutely.
I agree.
And I'm not so sure Thomas would though. Who is supposedly his protege? I'm not so sure.
So I wonder. I wonder when Donald Trump is elected and Mickey Mouse just, or Donald
when
Duck
you when you just said that
to the court
when you just said that when you just said those words when Donald I heard yeah. there was a bunch of horses rising up on their back legs you know
like the horsemen of the apocalypse
I could hear them outside my window. It was terrible. I hope the folks at home didn't hear it.
You know, hopefully it'll take a while to get up to the Supreme Court so that we won't have a hobbled court dealing with this issue, but interesting. Wow. It's really interesting because I knew about these Stingray things, but I didn't know that there was this case in the works. And frankly, I'm not surprised by the decision because there have been it was the Jones case, 3 years ago from the Supreme Court that held along similar lines with basically a concealed GPS device on a vehicle.
Right.
Same way. So, all right. Well, interesting stuff. We got to take a break so that we can have our sponsors pay the radio station money to be able to hear
God
stuff
bless
they're
them.
Selling.
God bless them.
Yeah. We'll be back right after these messages. Stay tuned.
You're listening to Legal Defense with Kirk O'Bear on 1330 and 101.5 WHBL.
Welcome back to Legal Defense. Today, this week, I shouldn't say today, earlier this week, Thursday, as a matter of fact, the FBI announced that they were officially closing the open case of Mr. D.B. Cooper. You know who that is?
Oh, is that the one that's open for 45 years?
45 years. Mm-hmm. And they've just given up. It took them 45 years to give up. Now, what happened was... And for those of our listeners that don't have as many years on the odometer that you and I have, this goes back to 1971, I believe it was. And they call him D.B. Cooper only because that's like he used the name Cooper when he bought his plane ticket from, I think it was a short hop between Portland and Seattle, something like that. And, bought his plane ticket and got on the plane and wrote a ransom note, handed it carefully, casually to the stewardess. And it said, I want $200,000, 4 parachutes. And, then there's a bomb in my briefcase. And he showed her whatever was inside of his briefcase. And it had wires and what looked like sticks of dynamite and things like that. And, back then they used to comply with, I guess, whatever people asked for.
So they just had 200,000 laying around?
Well, I guess, because they landed the plane and they were careful to have... they had enough time to note the serial numbers of the money. But they gave him the $200,000 and the 4 parachutes. And then he ordered the plane to take off and he wanted it to head to Mexico. But before it got too much... along the route heading that way, he went to the back of the plane and parachuted out of the plane while still in Washington State, never to be seen or heard from again, and remained one of the most investigated yet unsolved mysteries in the FBI's file cabinet up until Thursday this week. Now, they estimate that it's not even known if he survived, and one reason why there is a question about, on the one hand, he may have not survived, is because in the 1980s, a kid found a big bundle of money in a creek in Washington, and it turned out that this was the money, some of the money, anyway, that had been given to him, and it was just, sort of floating around, or in some mud at the bottom of a creek. And it was about $1,000 worth. But they had this national ad that went out in every newspaper, and it kept on going for at least a few years after the incident, where if you found one of these $20 bills, you'd get $1,000, because they not only was it part of a crime investigation, but they became like the most highly sought after collected, monetary things in. What do you call that? Numismatic history? Is that what you call it when people collect money and stuff like that?
I don't know that. But you're using big words, and I can't follow.
Yeah,
them.
Maybe that's the wrong one. I don't know. But anyway,
I have a theory.
Philatelic interest. That's stamps.
I have a theory that
Some of these bills surfaced over the years, and so that led people to speculate. Not many, but some led people to speculate he survived. The air temperature when he bailed out of the plane was 69 degrees below zero. And he would have had to fall for at least, I think, a minute and a half to 2 minutes in order to, you know, expose to that temperature, which is hard to imagine if you weren't wearing some sort of highly protective clothing. Anyway, go ahead. What were you
going to
say?
Well, I was going to say that I think that they probably just put in the parachute enclosure just like, I don't know, they didn't have Pokemon cards back then, but, you know, something like that, some silly sort of, you know, a gag gift or something, and then he tried to open it, and, you know, he just plopped, and his body was just completely splattered. I did not know about the 69 degrees below zero. That seems highly unusual anywhere within Earth's atmosphere.
Well, no, very, very high. Well, it was 10,000 feet, and it was in, if I'm not mistaken, oh, it was winter. I don't recall what month it was in. But also, that's accounting for, you know, wind speed, airspeed, all this
stuff. Right,
right. I think it's an approximation with, like, the wind chill factor, I'm sure. But, excuse me. Anyway, that was one of the theories why he couldn't have survived. Anyway, FBI calls it quits, throws in the towel, can't find him. Must be dead, or we don't care anymore. That's basically what they
said. You know, we got terrorists to find at this point. Come on.
They've got to refocus their attention on all the presidential candidates.
Right. Well, plus, you know, they got some wall building to do in a few months. And
oh, yeah, that's going to be...
You know, I mean, so there's other priorities, and should be exciting.
So I've heard all the wall building contractors out there are really gearing up for some major bidding wars.
Oh, yeah. Well, who wouldn't be? I mean, come on. That's like a bonanza for them.
Yeah.
I mean, how just as I know this is kind of a different topic, but how many miles is that? It's like a couple thousand miles, isn't it?
No, it's more than a couple thousand miles. I don't know the answer to that, but just in my head, I don't know, 10,000, something like that? It's got to be.
No, the entire
border, including all of the... No, including all of the... twists and turns and winds and everything like that. I mean, it's not like it's just a straight line, right?
Just along the Mexican border? No, because I think it's 3,000 miles from coast to coast. So it's probably...
All right. I'm just thinking about the country being a lot bigger than it really is. All right. So let's just settle on a few thousand miles. Is that a good compromise?
I think that's a good compromise. But just
several, okay?
Think about that now. How, first of all, you have to build the wall high enough for it to do some good, and you also have to build it well into the ground to prevent tunneling, right?
Yeah. Like, in fact, I think you have to build it further into the ground than you do into the air.
Probably.
Yeah.
And so, I mean, I couldn't do the math on what that would cost, but astronomical would be my guess. Astronomical
sure.
cost.
But we're not paying
for it.
Oh,
that's right. I forgot about that.
No problem.
Because a foreign country is going to pay for it.
It's going to be made out of gold and it's going to be diamond encrusted. You know, it's going to be a fancy wall.
I totally forgot about that. Thank you.
So, I just wanted to mention real quickly, I know you had a couple of other really good stories to get into, but we've got just a couple of minutes before this break. There was an attorney disciplinary decision that came out earlier this week. And I don't know if you saw this, but the basis for the investigation was a not too uncommon scenario. An attorney who was representing a woman in a divorce ended up extending his, let's just say he went a little further than most lawyers go in terms of comforting her, you know, and that was the initial investigation is that. It came up that while he was representing her, he ended up in a relationship with her. Let's just put it that way. That's the best way to put it. But that was the initial problem. But the real, you know, problem that the Supreme Court had with the entire investigation is that he denied it repeatedly, not only to the Office of Lawyer Regulation, but also to the court inquired about the situation.
No, not good.
So,
not good.
So, you know, it was a situation that, you know, they could have dealt with by saying, hey, naughty, don't do that. Not a good idea.
Right.
And I want to come back to that.
As always, the cover-up is worse than the crime.
Right. But the gist of why they were so upset with him was that he, basically tried to deny it all. Now, a couple things about that. First of all, a lot of people do find it surprising to learn that there is a general prohibition against having a sexual relationship with a client, especially when you're representing that person. And I understand that, but it does seem a little invasive in terms of telling people how to lead their lives, because it's treating the client like they're either 5 years old or a puppy dog.
Well, you know,
like
I think
they don't have a choice.
I think the theory is kind of that, you know, that we're in sort of a superior power relationship with the client who's a very vulnerable. In theory, they're very vulnerable. You know, if you're
sometimes,
you know,
yes.
I mean,
yeah, I understand that.
I mean, that's not always true, but, you know, I guess it was probably enough of a problem at some point that's why the...
Right. I mean, it must have been a big problem if it became like a hot topic with the Office of Lawyer Regulation or back when they... remember when it was BAPR?
Right. Right.
The Board of...
Board of Attorneys Professional Responsibility. Yeah.
Professional responsibility, right. So if somebody got bappered,
right.
That meant that they were being...
It was used as a verb, yes.
That. Right. But, you know, his response, I think, you're right. You know, the denial ends up being worse than the offense itself. Sort of like, you know, the farmer that gets caught with the sheep and he's like, I was only helping it over the fence. But, you know, so basically, you know, he had the full string of denials that worked their way through the court system and just embarrassed the heck out of this guy. So now, I won't mention his name because you can look it up on your own if you want to. But yeah, I mean, he's now reprimanded for being naughty.
Mm.
So
okay.
Anyway, we've got lots of topics. Once again, I've got
some stuff
to flow with all
burning
of my silly
a hole
comments,
in my computer so. Here. So
all right, okay. We'll come right back right after these messages. Stay tuned.
Now, back to Legal Defense with Kirk O'Bare on 1330 and 101.5 WHBL.
Back once again. Hope you enjoyed those awesome commercial messages.
They were amazing.
Anyway, they were.
They were. I was on the edge of my seat. Seriously.
I wrote down all the stuff that I'm going to buy. So anyway.
Got your Christmas list together and okay, good.
Yeah. Hey, I had a good time at Summerfest, didn't you?
I had an awesome time at Summerfest. It's really fun.
You know what I couldn't believe? Here's the story that our listeners will appreciate. John and I went to go see Paul McCartney, and he got a hot dog, and I got a bratwurst. And I thought, okay, you know, that's dinner.
Mm-hmm.
And then we watched the show. It was great. And I think you got, like, a big bag of popcorn during the show. Then afterwards, John said,
I'm starving.
Well, and then we got some Greek food, gyros.
Oh, that's right. We got gyros.
Ate those, and then you were still hungry and were on a search for pizza after that. And
it's something about – it really probably wasn't actual hunger. It was just sort of like festival hunger, if that makes sense.
Festival hunger.
It was festival
hunger.
Well,
yeah, because there's a lot of food smells lingering in the air.
And it's just like
– And it was
– I wasn't drinking, so I just wanted – like I just had this wanton lust for food, and that was, you know.
And I had tried to save my hunger up, but I was done after that gyro. I mean, it was awesome. But
I'd been working out a lot, so I know. But
that's probably the explanation. I understand. But I almost got in a fight with the lady that was trying to pass off this. You know, I'm a pizza snob.
Oh,
and,
right.
You know, I see some of the stuff they serve and call pizza at some of these places, and I just it drives me crazy. It drives me crazy.
So I guess you're not buying, like, frozen pizzas and stuff like that?
I've never eaten a frozen pizza.
I'm sorry that I just insulted you. I apologize for that. I realize you're strictly a New York pizza kind of guy.
Yes.
There's actually a couple of really good New York pizza places in Milwaukee, so...
Okay.
Ian's,
well, of course,
NYPD. That's the name of it,
well,
NYPD.
Ian's is actually a, a chain because they have one in Madison. I know that. I've had that before. It's pretty good. Mm-hmm. But I'm interested in your NYPD concept here. That sounds good.
I have to tell you, I've ordered it a couple times. Outstanding. Really is. Really outstanding. So I don't know if it meets the Kirkle Bear standard of pizza excellence, but I'm just telling you.
Well, once you've eaten at John's Pizza in Greenwich Village, where they do it on in their ovens that they use charcoal. That's like the New York style. They use charcoal. And the crust is very thin but not crisp. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
There's, and you're able to fold it. And it's like the cheese, the sauce, somehow it all just comes together
so well.
How
about Lombardi's in, I think it's in Little Italy. Lombardi's, you ever heard of it?
I've been there.
Yep.
Yes, I've been there. Love it.
Took my son there. It was amazing. So, yeah. But, you know.
Oh, hey, best Italian joint that I've ever been to is called Sophia's in Little Italy. And if you've never been there, you've got
to
go.
I remember you texted that to me the last time I was in New York, and I couldn't fit it in. But but I'll make a note of that. I love going to Little Italy, especially like trying to figure out which one of the restaurants is actually full of gangsters, because there's always like one or two.
I know. So like the way you were at Summerfest, where you kept on eating even though it made no logical sense, like to keep eating.
Yeah,
that's how I am in Little Italy. I'm just like, okay, I just ate an entire meal, but I want more food.
But yeah, you know? I'm just gonna do it because I don't, you know, I'm not gonna come here for a while, so I'm just gonna do it. Yeah, I gotcha.
All right. So hey, you had some other stories lined up. Yeah. I keep on diverting the
topics.
What?
You know what? No, you got the diversion. You know, we've had so much misery in the last couple of weeks with the shootings in Minnesota, in Baton Rouge, and then of course the assassinations in Dallas. That you know, it raises. I'm sure you've read all of the many, many multitude of articles about the black-white divide in this country and how it's
every day.
It's sort of it's really reaching kind of a zenith right now with these incidents. I mean, the president shows up in Dallas. He's having big powwows in the White House between police, activist groups and law enforcement groups, and as he should. I mean, those were appropriate meetings, but it raises the issue, at least in my mind, is let's put this into some context. And that's when I ran across an amazing article by a guy by the name of Daniel Beyer, who did some serious analysis, like factual statistical data analysis of just how dangerous being a police officer is. So, and I'll preface this by saying that his conclusion is the same that I think that you and I would conclude, which is that it is a dangerous job. It's always been a dangerous job, but there's always a but, right? It is far, far safer now than it was 40 years ago or 30 years ago. And the numbers bear it out. Let me float some of the numbers past you here. Police deaths per million residents, 1971, it was 1.2. It's the lowest now than it's been since then. It's down around 0.1. Felony killings of police per year. 1970s, 114, 2010 to 2014, 51. Mm-hmm. So 2015 was the third safest year for cops since the 1800s. That's just fact. Cops are almost eight times less likely to be injured by guns today. Assaults, assaults and injuries of police officers with firearms, they're down almost in the last available context, it's down like 400%.
You know what I wonder, and I hear what you're saying, and that all is very valuable information, but it also sounds like the kind of statistics that you would hear from, say, for example, an NRA lobbyist, because you know, the availability and the regulation, you know, the ownership of guns and how it's been something that has been, I think, increasing. The numbers bear out that more citizens possess firearms now than they did in the 70s, I suspect. It sounds like an argument that it's really not making life more dangerous for police when more people have guns. Now, I don't think that's true, but I think that we're also living in an era where
I don't think.
And I just want to say this. Hold on. Yeah, hold on. Okay, Let me say something here. I think the fear now in a different – it's a different type of world. I mean, bad guys were bad guys back then. And when people did stuff, it was a different motive, I think, you know, at least in terms of the psyche of our country and the things that we fear. And what I mean by that is that things appear to be – the fear that we really have is something that's completely indiscriminate and a mass shooting where – you know, because that's what's in the media. And we hear about it a lot more and a lot more quickly now. So although statistically it may be – that an officer is more safe. I think that one thing we need to recognize, and I'm not saying this justifies, you know, killing people, of course, but I'm saying that one element to this that we have to acknowledge in our analysis of what has changed over the years is that when something bad happens, it gets instant press, and it happens like practically every day, if not in this country, somewhere in the world where some, you know, jerk has a gun and is killing people in a movie theater or a mall or whatever. And it's, you know, it just kind of leads us all to be suspicious of everyone around us. And it's got to bleed into those that are tasked with protecting all of us. I mean, you know, good statistics and everything to know that that's not a justification in and of itself.
I think the,
to say that.
I think the point here was that it really was attacking what's called availability bias, which is. Where you make a mental shortcut and come up with an explanation, given the like the what's immediately available in front of you, the specific topic, concept, you know, whatever,
okay.
You know,
so,
and
so
and that's and that's
put another way,
and so the
war on
cops meme that's going on right now is just not accurate. You know, there's not a war on cops. I think there's a stronger argument to say that there's a sort of a slow motion attack on people of color across the country. But part of the problem is that white people that live in nice, comfortable situations
I'll agree with you in the sense that there isn't a widespread movement to kill police, but there is a trend, a disturbing trend that has been thrown at us, and you know, constantly, and rightly so, exposed every time that there is an apparently unjustified police killing of another person, usually a black man, that causes this sort of uproar. And that's the thing we need to look at, is the fact that,
well, absolutely, they're two sides of the same coin, right?
Yeah, they are. Well, we got to take a break, so we will be back right after these messages. Stay tuned. This is Legal Defense with Kirk O'Bear.
It's Legal Defense with Kirk O'Bear on 1330 and 101.5 WHBL.
Welcome back. You still there, John?
Still here.
Good.
Raring to go.
Let's keep talking then.
All right. So, yeah, well, we're talking about
people killing each other with guns.
People killing each other with guns, and more than just people, people with badges that have guns also. And I guess the point that this article was trying to make, at least from my perspective, was that we shouldn't automatically assume because one guy has a murderous rage in him and he shoots down and he lays out five police officers, you know, as part of his own personal race war, doesn't mean that there's a quote-unquote war on cops. One would be quick to, if you're Donald Trump, for example, that's all you see. Because now he's the law and order candidate, right? That's why this context is so important, is because he is literally picking up Richard Nixon's political strategy.
Right, the silent majority, right?
The silent majority, law and order, and it's the dog whistle to the racist South. You know, remember his Southern strategy, right?
It's a very deep political well that you can always draw from.
Right, and frankly, Trump's been doing this since he announced over a year ago, and sometimes in very blatant ways, you know, calling all Mexicans, you know, rapists and murderers. Oh, but some of them are nice people. You know, I mean, that's, you know, that's, but he's also been
when
very...
When he says, the judge in my case, of Hispanic origin,
I'm just saying he's Mexican.
But, hey, I want to build a wall. You know,
yeah, I know.
Talking out of both sides of his mouth.
You're going to have to work on that Trump imitation, but
that wasn't that good.
It wasn't that bad either.
I didn't sound like an idiot. I tried.
You got to go huge. So huge. But you know, the point is that unfortunately, a lot of these sort of subtexts of political movements and sort of arguments. All really have this underlying us versus them thing. So whether it's, you know, citizens versus cops, blacks versus whites, you know, elites versus lower class or middle class or whatever, you know, it's this us versus, and you can see that he skillfully plays that in even in his main theme. What's his main theme? Make America great again. Well, you know what? America is awesome.
And so in order for that to really work, America's got to be awful now. It's got to be as bad as can be.
Well, you can't get elected if you're saying things are pretty good right now. If you just elect me, I'll make them better. No, you have to make it sound like the thing is everything's gone to hell in a handbasket, and Obama is the devil incarnate, and I will come in and fix everything, right? Mm-hmm. And that's what he's trying to do. Hillary actually is from a political theater sort of standpoint, she's sort of at a disadvantage because she's actually saying, "Oh, things are pretty good, and Obama's done good."
You know what's really interesting about all of that, and the thought crossed my mind. It has crossed my mind more than once. You know, especially in the political environment that we live in now, and I suspect it's been, you know, the same in many, many years ago when things were also contentious. This isn't the first contentious election we've had where, you know, people were upset with all candidates that were running. But, you know, one reason that I think there is carte blanche for a candidate to make outrageous promises as part of a campaign nowadays is that when they get elected and then the things don't happen that they promised, they can just blame the Congress, right? I mean, isn't that a ready-made reason why the things that you wanted to get done can't happen?
I was trying, and, you know, these guys just won't do it.
But
you know?
The naysayers stood in the way, and then my plan didn't work.
In Obama's case, they really were just trying to screw him all the time.
Right.
He's
right when he says that the people.
He's 100%. I mean, look at this. Look at Merrick Garland's nomination, for God's sake. I mean, just saying, we're just not playing. We're not even talking to you.
People need to look at that, though. Just because the Trump has a great idea, you know, what he thinks is a great idea to build a ridiculous wall on the border. Well, he doesn't just get to say build a wall. It's gotta go through appropriations. Funding, committees, and all this stuff. He's got to deal with Congress. It's separation of powers, but he's also got to deal with there's got to be Democrats in Congress. He can't get rid of them. You know, it's not going to be as easy as he thinks. And that's the silly thing about a lot of what he says. None of it's realistic.
I think he's going to get rid of the Democrats. He's going to send them all to Mexico to help build the wall and then leave them on the other side.
He'll probably make the wall. Hey, here we go. He'll make the wall out of Democrats. He'll like build it.
See, now you're thinking outside the box, Kirk. That's what I call. That's gonna, you know, that's great thinking right there.
He's gonna steal that idea.
I know we talk about the law a lot, but this is on politics, and this is what's amazed me about. And let me just start by saying I used to be addicted to politics and everything about it, presidential politics, local politics, congressional politics, international politics, whatever it was, right? And but the political elections in this country are literally full-time business. There's never a non-election time, right? You're either in an election or you're getting ready for an election. So that's just
the fact. So I bet you feel kind of jealous that now John Oliver, Samantha Bee, all those folks, they've got their own shows where all they do is basically say things that you've been thinking, you know, your whole life. And they're making money out of it, you know?
I would love that job. I don't know if I'm talented enough for it, but this is what
Just let me insert this because it really bothers me. It bothers me a lot that somebody else has the job I would like and they've got it nailed. Have you ever seen Bizarre Foods?
No.
It's a... this guy that
watches food shows.
He travels all over the world, which is what I would love to do. As part of my, you know, like dream job, it would be traveling everywhere throughout the world. And he goes and he eats weird stuff, which is my second favorite thing to do. You know?
I thought you only ate pizza. I thought you
I'm fearless. You could give me anything and if you dare me, like a bowl
full of beetles.
Sure. Yeah, it's stuff like that.
All right.
Monkey brains, how about
a beetle pizza? How about a beetle pizza? I bet you would not eat a beetle pizza.
But the point is this. Other people live in that place, and there's a reason why they're eating it. Usually because it, like, either tastes good or there's something about it. I don't know. I mean, and they're all still alive. So, you know, if it doesn't kill you, it makes you either stronger or smarter. That's what I think. But anyway, back to your point.
Kirk Nietzsche. all right. So, anyways, yes, the point I was making was, before I was so rudely interrupted by Mr. Food Search over there, is that we have this, it's sort of a perverted system of, I'm sure that the founders never would have envisioned this constant election cycle here, but it really brought it into focus after the Brexit. Because David Cameron immediately after says, you know what, I'm stepping down. I'm not the person to take you into this next era. And
it's because he practically dared people to vote against it or for it or whatever. He was if you're going to keep on harassing me, just send it to a vote.
It's the transition of power that amazed me. A couple of days later, look at this. We have this new prime minister, and she is going to move into 10 Downing Street in a couple of days. Right. There was no muss and no fuss. There was no campaign. There was no nothing. It was like these highly competent people who just happened to disagree. And so this parliamentary system, you know, I was never a fan of it, but it certainly has.
Why?
Some
I think it's fascinating. Do you ever watch it, like on the BBC? I love watching parliamentary hearings. It's awesome.
I love when they have the the questions for the prime minister.
Yeah. Snotty questions. Like,
I think we should absolutely do that in the United States.
How can you justify all of the cows that are running onto my property, Mr. Prime Minister?
You know.
Well, now, Mr. Lord, don't they have lords and commoners or something?
Yeah,
like
they
that?
Do. Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
So, my lord.
We should do that.
What I'm trying to do is make it go back to the traditionalists when it comes to our legal. In my own little world, the only thing that I can touch directly are the lawyers in our community. So I am hoping to propose that we all wear wigs in court, and I'm trying to get more support for that.
Robes and wigs. How's it going
so far? Well, I'm the only one that has signed up for it, but, you know.
Okay. I think you'll look. I think you'll blend right in if you're the only one. I don't think it'll be a problem, and I highly encourage you to do that. Do you have court tomorrow? Do you have court next week?
Not on Sunday. No. Yeah, next week.
Yeah, you must have court tomorrow.
Yeah, I think I'll do that. I do. I need to look and see if I have an old powdered wig in my closet someplace.
And you should bring like a musket with you too, just so you really get sort of a colonial feel to you, just in case there's some.
Hey, who's
British
the judge in who's the judge in Milwaukee County that has a gun? Do you know what I'm talking about?
No, I don't.
Yeah, there's a judge that sent out a letter to everybody that said, just so you know, I'm packing in the courtroom. And I don't remember who it is, but there's a judge in Milwaukee County.
John Seifert, maybe?
Oh, yeah. You know, that would make sense if it is.
because he was a former cop, and he does, he likes to do daring and amazing things.
That's one way of putting it.
He does.
He likes to come face to face with the law, and
at least daring and amazing in his definition.
Have a staring contest with it. So anyway, hey, we're out of time. So we'll have to continue the fun next week, please. Yeah. Please tune in 8 o'clock a.m. Saturday morning next week, just like you can every single week from here until eternity. Or listen to us on the web. You can podcast the show or listen to the podcast, I guess I should say. This has been Legal Defense with Kirk O'Bear and John Birdsall. Say goodbye, John.
Bye.
See you next week.